Welcome to Living the Dream Podcast. This is Yana. Now, Foxconn, the world's largest maker of computer products, which does work for Apple, Sony, and IKEA, announced today that it's hiring 1 million robots in the next 3 years, potentially putting thousands of Chinese factory workers out of a job. This might be big news to some, but not to today's guest, Martin Ford. He is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and author of The Lights in the Tunnel, a clarion call to our political and economic leaders to consider the implications of a world in which automation handles millions of jobs performed by regular people today. It's a fascinating read, and we're glad to have Martin on the line with us.
Thank you.
Now, in the book, you give us a little bit of background about your career, but what inspired you to make the leap from entrepreneur to the main writer hammering at this issue?
Well, I run a small technology business, so I have involvement in these types of technologies. I use them in my business, all kinds of automation. I've been involved with technology for about 25 years, so I've seen how it's accelerating, and it's an issue that I've been wondering about for some time. And I think as we found ourselves in this economic crisis, it really kind of focused my thinking, and so I decided to sort of lay out my ideas on this, because I do think it's going to be a huge concern for the future in terms of the impact on the economy and in particular the job market.
And you make two points about that tie pretty closely in the current recession. One is that obviously automation, most people know that automation is coming to certain low-wage jobs and making it even more difficult for people who have been impacted by this recession to get jobs. And then it's also starting to affect industries that have been for a long time tied to more educational experience, which is important to note for today's graduates who are often having trouble finding entry-level work that maybe people a generation ago could have slid into more easily.
Right. In general, what you can say is that it doesn't have anything to do with particular industries. It has to do with the type of job. And in general, what's happening is that any job that's, in essence, routine and repetitive, meaning that if it's the kind of job where people essentially come to work every day and do the same types of things over and over again according to some schedule, it might be the same thing every day or the same thing every month or whatever, regardless of the skill level of the job, it's ultimately going to be susceptible to these types of technologies, in particular things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, robotics. Even someone like, for example, a radiologist, someone that requires a college degree and then a medical degree and then another 5 years of training after that, what they're doing is they're coming in and they're looking at visual images, and they're essentially doing pattern recognition. They're looking for something on an image, and that's something that the computers are getting extraordinarily good at. So I don't think there's any doubt at all that a lot of work of that type at some point is going to be almost fully automated. So, having lots of education isn't necessarily going to protect you at all. In many cases, the types of jobs done by people with college degrees and even advanced degrees are going to be even more threatened, because they're essentially knowledge-based jobs where you're just sitting at a computer manipulating information in some way. And, to do that job requires only software. It doesn't require fancy mechanical robot arms and all that type of thing. So this is something that hit jobs at all levels, from low-wage jobs to the very highest level type jobs.
Now, in contrast to some other people writing on this subject, in your book, you specifically try not to take too fantastic an expectation of what's coming soon. So you say, even taking conservative understandings of how fast technology is developing, this is going to be a problem. But to use a concrete example, right, Walmart recently denied that it would be switching to stacking its shelves with robots after hours anytime soon. How close are we to that kind of technology, seemingly fairly basic stuff like that?
Right. I would guess that, it's very difficult to pin down, but I'd be surprised if we don't see within 5 or 10 years that type of thing. And it could be, long before then. I mean, we already have, if you look at what's happening in warehouses, for example, that's already highly automated. It seems fairly obvious to me that that technology is going to start to creep from the warehouse to, you know, the retail storefront. The other thing that's going on is you're seeing the vending machine type technologies are really taking off. You obviously see now video rental machines, you know, and this is something that's been going on for a long time in Japan. So there are technologies in place now that really offer, you know, self-service retail type experiences, and I think that's going to grow substantially. And those technologies are going to find their way moving from vending machines into stores eventually. Or you may at some point in the future see, you know, entire stores begin to look more like big vending machines in essence as that technology scales up. So there are a lot of ways that it can go, but I do think it's inevitable. You know, that once these things become affordable and effective enough, they will get used. It's very difficult to say exactly when that's going to be, but I don't think it's too far out.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned Japan, because I think that was the country that you used in your McDonald's article, right? That has a mostly automated McDonald's. I'm not sure if
The article I wrote, it was actually a sushi chain. There's a sushi chain over there that's highly automated.
Oh, right. So
robots that cut the sushi in.
Yeah, that's remarkable. But it also made me think about one. There's something that I kind of started wondering as I got towards the end of your book. I know that in a way it was kind of talking about the United States and how we could respond in terms of maintaining any semblance of a free market democracy in the age of advanced automation. But this technology is eventually going to come to countries almost one by one, won't it? I mean, there's developing countries that have very basic infrastructure right now. So even though in your book you often talk about, you know, the global economy and how it's going to be constrained by automation, isn't there going to be something more like a wave effect where it starts hitting a couple of, like, Germany and Japan and perhaps England and the United States and then slightly less developed countries? You know, how will that play out?
I mean, it's impossible to say exactly how it's going to play out, but I think it will have an impact everywhere. I mean, you just mentioned that right at the beginning of this, the Foxconn to move to robots. So obviously this is something that will impact China. In China, the biggest impact is going to be in manufacturing. And obviously, you know, in the United States, we've already seen tremendous automation in the manufacturing sector. I mean, you know, most people always say that manufacturing in the United States is dead or something, but that's really not true at all. We continue to manufacture, you know, far more than we used to. I mean, we still have a very vibrant manufacturing sector. What we don't have is the manufacturing jobs because, you know, technology has essentially eliminated them. And the same thing will happen in China. And you could argue that it may well happen faster in China than it did in the U.S. because China doesn't have to create the technology. It can largely just transfer existing technology from developed countries. I believe they will have a problem going forward in terms of maintaining, you know, their workforce employed over there, because it's going to be very difficult for them to transition to a service sector like the United States, because they're not really wealthy enough yet, and people there don't spend enough. I expect there will be problems there. In the United States, you know, the biggest thing impact here is going to be when automation comes to the service sector, because manufacturing is already largely automated. But now these technologies are going to encroach on the service type jobs, you know, retail jobs, office jobs. These types of things are going to get hit, and so that would be the biggest impact there. And the other thing to keep in mind is that everything is tied together. Most developing countries, to some extent, usually to a significant extent, are, you know, export driven. I mean, they're dependent on consumer demand in more developed countries for what's happening there. So as demand, you know, begins to stagnate or even fall in developed countries like the U.S., I mean, that's also going to have an impact on developing countries as well. So many of them could well be caught between these two factors, where on the one hand they're seeing declining export demand, and on the other hand, the industries that they do have are also being impacted by technology. So, I mean, it's clear that it's going to have a global impact. How it's all going to play out exactly country by country is very difficult to say. But I do think the United States is going to be, you know, the impact will be very, very heavy, because on the one hand, we're obviously on pretty much on the leading edge of the technology. And on the other hand, we have, you know, the weakest welfare state. We have the
the
poorest social safety nets for people that are impacted by this. We have the least intervention of the government in the market to try and regulate things. For example, you mentioned Germany, and Germany is a country that obviously is going to be impacted as well and is being impacted, but they have a very different strategy. I mean, when the recession hit in Germany, they moved to a work-sharing type program where they had workers, you know, work fewer hours but still remain employed. They had government provide subsidies to large corporations to try to, you know, keep people employed. And, you know, they did the types of things that I actually advocate in my book that we're going to need to do here. They're already doing that in Germany. So obviously the impact there is going to be not as dramatic.
I imagine when you wrote your book, you couldn't have foreseen that the debt ceiling crisis would play out the way it just did the last couple weeks. I mean, how is the kind of national mood, national political mood, affected the how you think we're going to be able to respond to these challenges that you've talked about?
I think it's easy to be very pessimistic. I mean, if you look at the deal they just made for the debt ceiling, it's all cuts. It's all austerity. Which really just accelerates the problem. I mean, when you're taking even more purchasing power out of the economy, you know, I think the huge problem that we have right now is with inequality, not just because that's somehow morally wrong, but because it effectively destroys purchasing power for 95% of the population, and it's concentrating income into the hands of 1% of the population, or even less than that, and those people are not going to spend the money. I mean, they're not going to go out and spend that. So you keep cutting and cutting and cutting, and you know, you take income out of the hands of the people that are going to spend it. You take confidence away from people that would go out and spend it, and so you simply at some point don't have enough people out there with the income and the confidence to drive, you know, a consumer-driven economy. And when you have all these austerity measures, you're just making that worse. You know, what we really need to do is to rebalance things and to get more income somehow into the hands of the people that constitute the bulk of consumer spending.
When you talk about the kind of drastic reforms needed, history has kind of taught us that often it's the counterintuitive leaders that have been able to make transformative decisions because of the natural base that they come with as they step off into another base's territory. I'm just thinking, for example, of Bill Clinton was able to pass certain welfare reform measures that Ronald Reagan never could. George Bush's Medicare expansion probably would have been, you know, slapped down if it was a Democrat. And right now, what Obama's doing with the social safety net would absolutely not have been tolerated if it was John McCain putting forward these ideas. So it almost seems like, in working off that model, it would have to be a Republican president who said that this is what we have to do for our country. Otherwise, he'd just be labeled a socialist, right? I mean, there are socialist elements of the plan that's needed. It's almost like in this national politic, there's no way a Democrat could get away with proposing them.
You're right. I think there's possibly an argument there. You know, the reforms that we have to do might be so dramatic that it's in some sense impossible to imagine, you know, a Republican really doing them. But in some sense, what you're saying is true. I think that you know, it's conceivable that a Republican president could govern to the left of where Obama is, because he wouldn't get the kind of intensive opposition, you know, from the Republican Party. Point.
What do you think of the ideas that you've suggested? Can they be implemented on a local level without scaring off local businesses? Take, you know, the San Francisco area or New York City areas that do tend to try to think progressively. Is there a way that, you know, municipalities can head off some of these issues, or is it just too interconnected a problem?
I think it would be very difficult, you know, for the reason that businesses would choose to relocate. I mean, there are certain local type things that could be done, perhaps, but generally, I think it has to be a national problem. It's the same kind of thing with healthcare. You know, if you've got, for example, if only a few states that offer comprehensive healthcare, then you're gonna have a sort of an adverse selection problem where sick people move to the state and businesses move out of the state, right? And that's going to create an imbalance. And you'd have the same sort of problem if you try to provide too strong a welfare state in one particular state and others. So I really believe it has to be a national program to cover everyone. If you doubt that, one thing you can do is look at Europe. You see how the differences between the countries in Europe huge problems that are going to potentially rip the euro apart. It's really something that has to be handled, I think, on a centralized basis.
So switching gears from politics back to technology for a bit, this is just one question that has been on my mind since way before I read your book. And when I was reading your work and Ray Kurzweil's work about the acceleration of technology, I couldn't help but think that there are some things in our society which have just not responded at all to this technology acceleration. For example, transportation infrastructure. There's a lot of lumbering subway cars and buses that are going out on tracks that were laid decades ago, water delivery systems that were installed a century ago that we can't fix. Even the construction industry, I spent a year down in the Gulf Coast after Katrina, and it would just be baffling to watch these slow-moving things try to pick up one big rock at a time while they cleared rubble. And I just wonder, obviously it's easier to make, software and small devices faster and better, but are we going to see some kind of transformative change in these more bigger infrastructural areas, do you think?
I think that's quite possible. I mean, there's no doubt that when we talk about accelerating technology, we really mean information technology. I mean, we're talking about Moore's Law and the fact that computers are doubling every 2 years. And it's what we've seen over, the past few decades is that the progress has really been focused on information technology and communications. When I was a kid, I used to watch Star Trek, and we thought, by the year 2000 and beyond, there would be all these fantastic things, flying cars and spaceships and so forth. Obviously, we really haven't seen that. What we've seen is that it's concentrated in information and communications. But I do think that there probably is going to be a pent-up disruptive effect at some point, and the reason is that what we've done is we've taken our basic ability to compute, to calculate, to manipulate information, and we've multiplied that in an astronomical way. I mean, if you look at the global capacity to, calculate and solve problems now as compared to what it was in 1970, I mean, it's an incomprehensible increase. Something has to happen as a result of that, and you will see that all that new capability is going to get ultimately, I think, focused in other areas, and it will cause, I think, major advances. I mean, we're not going to see in other fields like energy and transportation the kind of acceleration that we see in information technology. I mean, that's something that, is unique to this area, but we'll see disruptive breakthroughs as these technologies are deployed. And you see it, you do see the effect already. If you look, for example, in oil exploration, a lot of the advances that have taken place there are because of, underground computer modeling and that allow geologists to basically see what's under the ground, and that all comes from computers. So, there is an impact already, and I think it's likely that we'll see more advances going forward.
And I guess the last issue is education. You're a big proponent of education generally for cultural and society purposes, and we need to have an educated civilization if we're going to have to make these big adjustments. But what do you say to, a 12-year-old, a 15-year-old, somebody who's in charge of educational programming about how to balance, the importance of education with diminishing resources and the fact that job security and job futures are so uncertain for people who are just coming through the system now and who will be coming through the pipeline 10 years from now?
I mean, it's tough to answer, but I do believe strongly that we have to continue to invest in education. The problem is that we may not always be able to view education as being something that is vocational. right now the primary argument always at virtually every level for more education is that it's going to lead to a better job, a better career. And that's going to continue to be true, but, it may not be a total solution. I mean, as I've said, I think a lot of jobs that are taken by college graduates that are taken by more educated people are going to be very susceptible to this. So, we may find at some point, and there's evidence for this already, you've got right now half of college graduates coming out who end up in a job that doesn't require a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
So the argument for going to college at some point may not be, just do it because you're going to get a better job. But there may need to be a broader argument, and there may need to be broader support for it. But I do think it continues to be critical because we need to continue to educate people, because even if not everyone is going to be able to participate in the economy of the future and maybe have the kind of job that they expect, we definitely will continue to need a lot of people. And in order to get those people, we really have to educate everyone, and we also need to have an educated society. So we probably will need to have different policies, different incentives in the future to ensure that people continue to pursue education.
So I guess the last question is, because so much transformative change needs to happen to really tackle these problems head on, and we do fortunately have the benefit of some time to work with this, what do you tell people is a short-term thing to think about in addressing these issues? Is it expanding the social safety net more broadly, or what would you tell Washington policymakers if you met with them right now?
I would certainly be against all the stuff that we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we certainly need to, at a minimum, extend unemployment benefits and have a better safety net. I think it's going to be disastrous. Over the next year or so, we're going to have millions and millions of people who exhaust their unemployment benefits, but really are going to have nowhere to turn, because the job market isn't going to find a place for them. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen with that. I think a lot of people are probably getting pretty close to their limit. They probably cashed in their 401ks and exhausted their savings, and soon their benefits are going to run out, and I don't know what the impact of all that is going to be. But I do think that programs like unemployment insurance are, among the most important that we have, and we need to continue to provide those types of safety nets. If we just turn completely toward austerity, I'm afraid the result is ultimately going to be disastrous, both for the economy and socially. And I do believe we need to find some additional revenue. We need to raise taxes on the most wealthy people in order to provide more support for the people at the bottom. I think that's a no-brainer. That's something that is fairly obvious.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause if we don't do that, we're going to continue to sort of spiral, and we're continue to see society get more and more unequal, and the bulk of people are going to have less money to spend and less confidence, and that's ultimately going to that's going to have a heavy impact on overall economic growth.
Well, I completely agree with that. That's stuff that I think a lot of us would have agreed with even before this, reading your book. But I think what I love about your book is that it takes a very real problem and gets us thinking about it now. And hopefully this issue will start resonating with people. I mean, it's already so intuitive that when you talk about jobless recovery, there's got to be a culprit. So I just highly recommend this book to everyone, Lights in the Tunnel. Martin, thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we can talk again down the road.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye. My heart is human. My blood is boiling. My brain, I've